And thanks again for joining us for today's MSDN GeekSpeak webcast. Now it's my pleasure to turn the floor over to your first presenter, Glenn Gordon. Glenn, you now have the floor.
Great. Thanks very much, and welcome, everybody, to another episode of our MSDN GeekSpeak webcast series. It's the webcast series where you get your questions answered live by industry experts. As mentioned, my name is Glenn Gordon. I'm going to be one of your hosts today on our GeekSpeak, and my co-host today is Jennifer Marsman. Jennifer, how's it going?
I'm doing pretty well, Glenn. I'm excited to be back. This is my second time co-hosting GeekSpeak.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true. So you should be very familiar with how to do it now.
It's an awesome show.
So Jennifer and I are both developer evangelists, and I'm based in Atlanta, and Jennifer is in Michigan, right?
That's true.
And we meet a lot of folks in the community when we're going around and doing the things that developer evangelists do, like present at launch events and speak at user groups. And a lot of the people that we meet in the community are deep experts in a lot of topics. So the GeekSpeak series is an opportunity for us to get those experts some airtime and let folks that sign onto these webcasts live get their questions answered in real time. So, Jennifer, what's new in your neck of the woods? I know we were talking a little bit before the show about the fact that we'll both be at the CodeStock event that's coming up in Knoxville, Tennessee in a couple weeks.
Yeah, there's always a bunch of great events going on in the summer. Both CodeStock and DevLink are two very large events being held in Tennessee this summer, so I'm very excited for both of those events. In addition, this summer we have a whole bunch of Give Camps coming up, and I'm extremely passionate about the Give Camps. That's a whole weekend of coding for nonprofit organizations, and there are Give Camps being held in Ann Arbor, Columbus, and Cleveland this summer during the month of July. So I'm really excited to have those happen and get a chance to give back using our actual skills as developers to give back to nonprofits as opposed to just donating money. It's just such a different way to give and just such a fulfilling weekend. You know, you don't sleep much, but you come home just feeling like, whew, I did something good with
my skills. And those are information on those is at givecamp.org, right?
Givecamp.org is correct, yes.
Excellent.
So we're having some trouble with hosting, so the site was temporarily down. I'm not sure if it's back up yet, but givecamp.org, definitely check that out.
Okay.
There's a listing on there of all the Give Camps throughout the U.S.
Awesome. Well, Jeff is from your neck of the woods, so do you want to introduce him, and we'll get the ball rolling on the GeekSpeak.
All right. Jeff is someone who's been very active in our local developer community in Michigan. He's based in Lansing. He's a regular on our speaker circuit, speaking mainly about web testing, specifically with a web focus. And he's the recent author of a fabulous book that I am halfway through, Jeff. I have not finished it all yet. But it's Testing ASP.NET Web Applications. The publisher is ROX. And it's a great book. And Jeff co-wrote that along with Ben Hall from the UK. And Jeff, it's absolutely an awesome book and great for anyone who's interested in testing and wants to learn a little bit more about it, especially in the web domain. And Jeff, feel free to go ahead and introduce yourself as well.
Oh, wow, great. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the show, guys. My name is Jeff McWhorter. I am the Director of Development at a company called Gravity Works Design and Development, located in Lansing. And I'm a web tester. I've been writing websites for years. Really enjoy testing and testing patterns and all that sort of jazz that goes with it. So thanks again for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you.
I was just going to find out a little bit of background, Jeff, on what interests you specifically about web testing and, what was the impetus for desiring to write a book?
That's actually a pretty easy question to answer. I enjoy my weekends, and I like to leave work at 5 o'clock every day. So when I leave, I like to have functional code. I like to do builds and have the code work, and I realize that to do that, you actually have to have some procedures around testing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where it comes from. Really enjoyed that, kind of latched onto the different testing stuff around there. When I was in college, a good story is that went to college, was in comp sci and telecommunications, and all the professors were jumping up and down that you have to write tests, you have to have automated tests, blah, blah, blah. And went out into the industry about 2000, 2001, and nobody was doing anything with automated tests, automated builds, anything like that. So it kind of piqued my interest as to why people weren't doing that, and learning about different management styles and why managers don't see value in it. And I just went, took off with it, just went from there and started preaching the good word about testing.
Cool.
Yeah, that's so true. When I did development for Microsoft way back in the day, we definitely did hardcore unit testing as well. And I remember when I first started with Microsoft, it's like, but wait a second, you know, at Microsoft we have dedicated testers as well as developers. And I remember it seeming strange to me that, oh, I as a developer am responsible for these unit tests? Why should I have to do that? We have testers. But then, oh my goodness, did I see the light of unit testing and the reasons for that. And so at Microsoft, the way we do our core development is the developers do unit testing, and then all the other kind of layers of testing, there are other testers in or people in actual test roles who go on and kind of do the functional testing as well as performance and stress and security testing. So
cool.
It's
yeah,
definitely so important.
I'm going to remind folks that are on the call that they can type their questions in the Q&A pane, and we'll ask them in a minute. Do you want to give us maybe some background, Jeff, on some of the unique things that people encounter with web testing that they wouldn't encounter with maybe a standard Windows or another type of application?
Well, yeah, sure. There's a lot of the stuff that you get like with Windows applications that you should be testing for, too. Jennifer mentioned unit testing. We want to test our units of work. We want to create very small units of work. We still get this when we're on the web. But we have a lot of other types of testing that we have to do, too. Security testing is a pretty important one. Being on the web, a lot of companies are pushing their stuff out to the web, and the access that people can get to, they're out there, so people could hack them. They could access information that you may not want to be visible. So it's very important with security out there. You don't have the confines of an intranet, such as like a Windows app in many situations.
Right.
Performance testing is huge. You still have to do that with intranet and Windows apps as well. But performance testing on the web, most of the time, smaller applications, there's one web server, one database, maybe they're the same box, and your website grows massively, you're the next Facebook, and you didn't know that, and then all of a sudden you get what we call the Slashdot effect. Slashdot's a website, News for Geeks, if you're not familiar with it, but what happens is it's a news aggregate site, and when your hot topic or your blog post gets posted on Slashdot, all that traffic that goes to the site is now directed to your site, and in many situations it brings down your site because of the mass amount of traffic. So we want to do testing for that and make sure everything's okay and working right. Accessibility, a lot of people hear the word accessibility, not to be confused with usability. Accessibility is making sure everybody has access to your program, meaning disabled people. If somebody has a vision disability, cognitive disability, they're still able to use your application. We hear a lot about that on the web, but we still have to deal with that when we're testing Windows applications as well. It's just a little bit more prevalent on the web. Those are a couple different types of things that are specific for the web.
Sure. Okay. We actually have a question from William in the queue. He says, are you finding that MVC and MVVM is helping partition the code into testable components? I think maybe we should talk about what those are first and then talk about their testability.
Sure. We can talk a little bit about MVC. MVC more so. Model View Controller, it's a design pattern that was developed way back in the 70s, actually.
Yeah.
And Microsoft has recently deployed out a framework, the MVC framework. And what it does is Model View Controller, it separates the concerns that you have viewing between your usability, your controls, and then your data, and actually processing with the control, all the control in the middle. So you have these nice little chunks to be able to test with. A lot of people hear MVC and that it's great to test with. It definitely is. It makes it easy. But you can do a lot of this testing that we're going to be talking about with web forms. Web forms are the normal. You create an ASP.NET website. That's what we have to work with, and that's what 95% of all developers on the ASP.NET platform are using out there. And I focus mainly towards talking about web forms because that's what everybody uses. I talk about testing web forms and how to do that. We hear terms like TDD, test-driven development, and how it works great with MVC, with the MVC framework. Yeah, that's true. You still can do TDD development, test-driven development, with web forms. It's a little bit more difficult. There's a lot more things that you have to do to get things set up and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I will definitely say I'm not a TDD guy. I've practiced TDD. I've been on projects where all the developers were doing TDD. But that's not really my style. A good friend of mine, Jay, actually coined the term, I wouldn't say coined, but uses it with me all the time, test eventually development.
Mm-hmm.
And the eventually isn't a week later. It's probably about a minute after I write the function. I'll write the function, and I'll make sure everything's abstracted out, and then I'll write tests to make sure. And I don't write tests for every single thing that I do. There's probably a lot of people jumping up and down right now just about, yes, you should write tests, and that's just preference. It's, are you delivering code that is functional? Yes, I am. Do I get bugs in my code? Absolutely. If I was doing TDD, would I have less bugs? Probably. But at my skill level where I am in my career right now, I am able to push out code faster and more quality by doing the practices that I do.
Okay.
Yeah, that kind of leads to a good question. How do you develop like a test plan for an application when you're writing it? So if you were, for instance, an independent consultant and you let's say you're giving this advice to an independent consultant and they are looking at an application and when they're done they kind of have to test it. We've mentioned a lot of different types of testing, unit testing, performance testing, accessibility and security testing. How do you sit down and determine what all needs to be tested and what is okay not to test and form a test plan when you're working with an application?
It's very important to figure this stuff up front because if you're going to have to go back and try to do this performance testing at the very end, it's going to be very difficult and you're going to run into issues that you could have avoided from the very beginning. The first thing that I like to start off with is asking them the Facebook question. Do you think your application is going to be the next Facebook? And a lot of people, and as an independent contractor myself, a lot of applications are, no, this is an internet website that 10 people are going to use. Just because it is an internet site doesn't mean that we still don't have to worry about things like accessibility and testing. So, but we know that we can scale back the amount of testing that we do. There's some tools that we can use. Usually if somebody says, I'm not going to be the next Facebook page, there's a tool that I use in Firefox called YFlow, and it's a free plugin, and what it does is it kind of gives you some information about your pages as you're rendering them. And I use that as a developer. I'm kind of looking at that as the page is spinning up, as it's just loaded. I look at the statistics that gives me back and says, and it'll say, you're loading 15 JavaScript files. Maybe you should not load as many of those. So then I'll do a process to combine the JavaScript files and make less requests on the website, stuff like that. I do start off with performance. I talk a lot to them about performance. I talk to them about accessibility as well at that point. If it's an e-commerce site, a lot of times I tell them it's very important to be an accessible website. There's a good story about the Target Corporation and accessibility, and there was a vision group out of California that went to Target a few years back and informed them that their site wasn't accessible there. And there was the vision issues, people using a screen reader called JAWS. Go off on a tangent here. What JAWS is it's a screen reader. It reads everything on the screen for people who have vision disabilities. And there were some issues with JAWS, how it was rendering out the website, how it was reading back the website to users. And the vision group was really nice and with Target and basically told them, you know, hey, we're willing to help you. Let us know what we can do to help you. Long story short, Target wasn't willing to help them, and a lawsuit happened, and then they had to go back and fix it anyway. But any e-commerce site, because you're going to lose customers if they can't use your site, so you might as well make that site accessible.
Sure. Do you have some tips? I mean, I think a lot of people might realize that for things like image tags, there should be an alternate text specified. But are there more subtle things like usage of divs or the usage of spans or anything like that people should pay attention to for
sure.
Websites to make them more accessible?
Sure. Since we're going down this tangent now, going this way, and that's one thing about me and tangents is everybody always tells me I have a story for everything, and I just go off on tangents about everything. So just so everybody's aware, that's what's going to happen on this webcast here. But accessibility, some things that we can do for accessibility. I always like to say that you need to put yourself, you have to have the perspective of somebody who is disabled. So there's lots of types of disabilities out there. There's vision disabilities, cognitive disabilities, which are learning disabilities. There's mobility disabilities, people who can't use their hands or use certain muscles in their arms. And there's lots of things that we have to think about with that, with the web. Most commonly, people think about vision disabilities. And most of the accessibility rules that are out there revolve around that and how the HTML is actually formed. As Glenn mentioned, what we're doing is the semantic way of the website. We want it to be very semantic. And by semantic, it should look like a book outline. If you took off all your CSS, all your JavaScript, everything out, what we want to do is have it look just like an outline of a book. Have a heading 1, your H1 tag, and you only have one H1 on your tag, and then you would have lists and divs and spans all in there, so you have very semantic, very clean website. Mm-hmm. Not only does that make it easier for screen readers to read, it makes it easier for web designers to go in there and apply styles and clean up and do what you need to do. The other thing to think about, and we've been hearing this for years, is to not use tables with formatting. A lot of people take this to the extreme, and they think that you're not supposed to use tables at all. Tables are used for tabular data.
Yeah.
So if you need to display data on your website that looks like something out of an Excel spreadsheet, you're perfectly fine using tables with a couple rules. You're supposed to have some headers and a caption and a couple other things with that, just how you format them. But if you decide that you want to have a top navigation bar, you're not going to want to use a table row for that. You're going to want to use div tags, dividers, different spans, different things like that to do that. Another common thing with accessibility that I hear all the time is I can't use JavaScript on my site at all. And there's all these laws written, all these rules about accessibility, WCAG 1.0, 2.0, Section 508 compliance, all these things that were written by lawyers for developers to read and follow. And I'm definitely not a lawyer, and I had a very hard time when I first started developing for accessibility learning exactly what these things said.
Sure.
And I was one of those developers that misinterpreted one of the rules in WCAG 1.0 that says my site can't have JavaScript very much. Basically what that says is your site needs to be able to work with JavaScript turned off. So a good example of that is think of an accordion style menu sort of thing where you have a list of all these things and you click a button and then it shoots down some information. Expanding div tags is another term people call those things. It's a nicety for the users to be able to go to it and kind of collapse things as they're going, but if you turn that off, if you turn JavaScript off, your site's still going to function. It's just not going to be as pretty and as usable for somebody with that can see correctly.
Right. I've heard that's sort of like referred to as degrading the performance based on the capabilities of the browser, right?
Yep. Oh, yeah. Yep. Yep, definitely.
Yeah, I think a lot of people might take shortcuts and just they'll automatically write the AJAX way to do it, and they won't provide sort of a backing simplified version of JavaScript turned off. And that's one of the reasons I like some of the controls in ASP.NET that output some JavaScript types of things to make a more interesting UI is that they degrade gracefully. And that also is like the validation controls. If you have a validation control that says a number that's typed into this input field has to be in this range, if you've got JavaScript turned on, it'll catch it before it gets posted back to the server. If the JavaScript's turned off, it has to do the round trip, but it still won't allow that input to go in if it's not in the right range, and it'll display the message. So I think that's a good example of something that degrades gracefully.
Right, and you brought up the validation. This is a great point to talk about. This, too, is we've all seen the validation rules and stuff in ASP.NET, and a lot of people will just put a little star next to required fields.
Yeah.
Put a red star next to it. And that's not exactly accessible because what if somebody's colorblind or has a cognitive disability or is a little bit older and doesn't know what that star means?
Mm-hmm.
So putting the word required next to there, if you have room, is going to be more accessible than just putting that little star there.
I see.
That's a great point. One last question on accessibility, too. Are there any tools? I remember you mentioning before tools that can help people do accessibility testing and kind of make sure that you're doing a great job with that.
Yeah, one of the tools that I really like to use is a free toolbar for Internet Explorer. It's called the Web Accessibility Toolbar. And one of the things that it provides is it provides a whole bunch of simulations, simulations of what your site would look like to somebody who had retinal diabetes or what your site would look like to somebody with glaucoma or cataracts.
Wow.
And what this does is this really puts it in perspective of what your site looks like to somebody with one of these disabilities. Retinal diabetes is their blood clots on your eyes, and when you look at the website, it looks like little gray blurbs all over the website. And there's not much you can do to code for that particular disability, but it really puts it in perspective to somebody who has that disease, what they're going through, and if somebody did call, you know, you might be a little bit more patient to walk through them because you've seen through their eyes what your website's going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a big advocate about perspective and working with people who have disabilities and using sites. I'm actually very fortunate. My wife works at a credit union and has a fellow I've known for years who is legally blind. And when I have a website that is very hot that has to be accessible, I go right to him, and I'll take him out to dinner. I've consulted him lots of times and said, hey, can you take a look at this website? Tell me what you think of this. Are you able to use it? And in the very beginning, he used to come back all the time, I cannot use this website. I just can't use this website. It's very hard to navigate. And I've learned little tips and little tricks just of the trade that have made me able to work these websites out and work with him. And it's been great. It's a great experience that I have that resource that I can go to. And I encourage everybody to seek out usability and accessibility labs at universities. I know up in Michigan, Michigan State has a very large usability and accessibility lab that have resources like that and are actually very affordable for you to submit a site, and they'll just take a look at it. They'll just kind of read through it real quick and say, yep, looks good, or could do something, a very advanced accessibility study against it and tell you exactly how to fix things like that.
Cool. And Jeff, just a question on scalability of this type of testing. It seems like what we've been talking about is using a toolbar in IE, for example, to view pages and how they would be seen by people with the various disabilities. Is there any kind of automated way that can crawl your site and look for sort of key things and then build a report for you?
Yeah. I think the biggest thing is learning how to create accessible websites. And once you learn that and you're following these standards, when you actually go to do an accessibility test, it's fine using a toolbar to just check this page or check this or check that. I've implemented FX COPS rules on a lot of the projects that I do to follow certain coding standards. There's sites out there like Cynthia Says that will go through, and you can check which level of compliance you would like to comply, and it'll go through. But one of the best resources that we have is actually inside of Visual Studio 2010. We have some accessibility tests that we can do WCAG 1, 2, or Section 508 compliance, and your code will, when you go to compile, it will throw a warning saying, I don't think this is going to work. And sometimes it's wrong, sometimes it's right, but it at least gets your eyes there before you even publish it that, hey, I should be doing something to check this out.
Okay.
Very good deal. Let's move on to security testing. I think security is a hot topic for a lot of people, and especially when you're building websites. As you said earlier, Jeff, there's just so much out there. You're really putting your site out there and exposing it to people, and there's just so many hackers out there and so many ways to bring them down, not to mention all the different attacks that you know, man in the middle and server-side scripting and just so many things. What are some best practices in such around security testing?
All right. I will put a disclaimer on this one that I'm not a security expert. I am a web developer that does the very minimum that I can do to get my sites not hacked. When I do a presentation, I always ask the audience how many people have had sites hacked, and it's very surprising the number of people that have had sites hacked. And it's a different world that we live in compared to even 5 years ago. The script kiddies is a term where hackers will deploy tools that exploit certain coding issues that were in sites. And these script kiddies, they're not really hackers. They didn't develop the tools to actually hack into the site, but they just have enough knowledge to be dangerous and be an extreme nuisance using these types of tools. And when a college student has unlimited time in the summertime, or you know, a high school student has this time to just decide, I'm going to hack this particular site and see what I can find about this site, there's pretty much nothing that we can do. Safes are rated based on how long it takes to break into a safe, and that's pretty much what websites are too. It's not a matter of if they can be hacked, it's just a matter of when they're
going
to.
How long does it take?
How it's going to take. And with those college kids and just kids just sitting there trying to do things, there's all kinds of things that happen. What I do to prevent this is I run off of a list called the OWASP Top 10 Security Risks. The OWASP is the Open Web Application Security Project, and it is just the best thing for developers out there. It's a wiki out there, and they actually spawn off into user groups. So there's user groups that meet monthly around the world. I believe there's one actually up in Grand Rapids, Michigan here, that meet, and they talk about security things. But not only security topics are talked about, they develop tools to help you analyze your site, and not only site, but other Windows applications and Java applications. And all these tools are open sourced up there. You can download the code. You can work on them. You can contribute to them. But the best part is it's a resource with all of this information there. And the security world is kind of a strange world. They're very secretive, the security experts. If you're going to have a security audit done on your site and you ask them, well, what exactly are you going to do? What tools do you want to use? They're very secretive about what they're using. And it's very strange to me as a developer because I'm very open with the tools I'm using, techniques that I'm doing, because I want to learn from other people and I want to teach other people the different things that I'm working on, because it's going to make my life easier. But for some reason, that world just does not exist. They don't have that sharing that we have in the programming world. But the OWASP project really opens us up and teaches people about this. And as I mentioned before, it's the OWASP top 10 that I always I code for and I write tests for. And the big thing is knowing about this stuff. And once you know about this stuff, you're going to be able to test for it, whether it's writing an automated test or whether it's doing a manual test. I still do a lot of manual testing, a lot of manual testing with accessibility testing, a lot of manual testing with the security testing to make sure things are working and things are okay. And the first one on that list is an injection attack. And an injection attack is like a SQL injection attack. We've all been jumping around as developers and speakers on this kind of speaking circuit telling people that SQL injections are bad and you shouldn't do that. That's where you're concatenating SQL together and putting in values. And there are still developers. I actually opened up a set of code, a code base that was written about a month ago, and the developer had concatenated strings in there with SQL. And I brought it up and I showed them and I said, hey, you want to see something cool? And I showed them a SQL injection attack. And it's one of those things that is still very prevalent in not only the .NET world, in the Perl world, the Ruby world. Everybody is still doing this. And it's one of those things that we have to code against, and we have to write tests to find that and strengthen our development practices to not do that.
Absolutely. What are some of the other things on that top 10 list? You mentioned injection flaws. I assume cross-site scripting is on that list as well?
Yep. Cross-site scripting is one of my favorite types of attacks because that one, I see that
go
all
down
the
favorites.
Time. Yeah, go down favorites. And that's pretty much what it is a list of favorites there. But it's actually what happens is you have some type of input on the screen, and you type the input, and then that input is rendered back to that website. So think of a web form where you're filling out a question or answering somebody's questions, and then you click post, and it goes there, and then people can read your little thing.
Right.
If you don't filter out the bad things, the scripts, and kind of encode different things and do some tricks with that, what happens is you can inject JavaScript in there. And a lot of people say, ah, JavaScript, that's not that bad. You know, we can, what's JavaScript going to do? But it can be very malicious to different things, reading cookies, deleting things, going to other websites, spawning off information and giving it to other people. So it's definitely one of those attacks that's very dangerous. But one of the good things about ASP.NET is by default, you can't do a cross-site scripting attack. If you try to post to a website and just put that content that the user entered in your little text box there onto the website, you get one of those nice yellow error messages that all of us ASP and .NET developers are accustomed to seeing, and you'll get an error message saying that you can't do it. Not to say that you can't do it. You can go into the actual page and do some configuration settings, and you can turn that off. You can turn it off in the web config. And I have seen sites that have done this for various different reasons and have exposed their site to cross-site scripting attacks.
I see.
So
one
of the tools that we can use for that is a tool off the Open Web Security Project website called WebScarab. And it's a tool written in Java. And what it does is it acts as a proxy in between your website and the actual web browser. And it kind of intercepts all the communication in between. And what you can do is you can set something up called a fuzzing template. And what fuzzing is it's going to all of those inputs and injecting a known list of exploits, known exploits like JavaScript, alert, foobar, and a couple different ways that hundreds of ways that I was unaware that you could actually do some different things with JavaScript to get cross-site scripting attacks to work. But what this will do is you can set up this fuzz template and go through and then analyze the results to see if you're susceptible to a cross-site scripting attack.
Wow. We have a question that's come in from Jacob, and he asked, what is the way to test the UI elements of a web form page?
All right. Testing a web form UI elements.
Yeah, that's an interesting one.
Yeah, there's a couple different tools that we can use that are out there. There's one set of libraries called Selenium, open source, and then there's another set of libraries called Watan, W-A-T-A-N, and then there is Visual Studio Test Edition, which you can do that too. And what all of these libraries do is they provide you with a framework where you can basically record a session of the UI. What happens is the UI renders, and then what you can do is you can right-click on a UI element, and then you can write an assertion for it. So you can assert that my page title is Jeff's website. And then if that page title doesn't render as that, you can, in your automated test, you can have that fail. So it's interface testing like that is, they're called fragile tests, because interfaces change very often. And what will happen is you'll get this big, long list of libraries of all these tests that you'll have, and then somebody will go and change some fundamental things about your master page or something, and then all of those tests break, and you have to go back and fix it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we try to do is we try to abstract as much code away from the UI as possible. And then that way we rely on our compiler to kind of do our testing for us. So inside of our code, we really care that there's a text box called foobar so that when we build, if that text box foobar isn't there, it really doesn't matter. And any logic that has to do with text box foo, if it expects certain parameters or certain things to be in there, we abstract that away out of the UI layer and then write tests specifically to check that text box to see if it has those properties or those characteristics on that.
How are those tools affected by AJAX programming techniques where you're actually changing the HTML DOM on the fly?
A couple of years ago when AJAX started to get popular and these tools were already out there, it was very difficult to use. But all of these tools have methods in there that revolve around AJAX and will expect parameters and expect things to change, and you can code for that. The big thing is a lot of the tools act as a recording. So what you do is you kind of do the recording, and then you play back the recording and then do your asserts after to make sure everything looks okay and everything is correct. So it's going to record those AJAX requests for you and then be able to handle those.
Okay. Do those tools integrate with, let's say, the testing frameworks for Visual Studio Team system?
Yeah, you can definitely use them with that. So it's kind of what it is it's if you have MS Test, and you could we could use MS Test, we could use NUnit, we could use MBUnit. That's our unit testing framework. And then these libraries kind of sit on top of that. And what these libraries do are they drive the browser, and they do driving the browser, and then the information that they receive back, they push it back to the testing framework like MS Test or NUnit, and then NUnit actually performs the assert to do, okay, is this string equal to this string? No, go red. And also Visual Studio, the testing tools inside of Visual Studio have their own set of own libraries that have been around for years that can drive the browser and perform these types of tests.
Okay. That's pretty useful, I think.
Yeah, it's some fun stuff. It's scary when you first get into it and you're on a very large project, seeing how overwhelming it could be. But once you get the hang of it, it's pretty cool, and you kind of learn what you should be testing for and what you shouldn't be testing for. You're not going to want to test to see that your color is red on every single page. Although I would say that if you have a developer that has introduced a bug where the color has changed from red to blue, you can write a test to do that, and then you'll be able to catch it. It's important, too, to mention JavaScript. JavaScript is another one of those things that people are starting to write tests for, and it's important to write tests for. And, again, the big thing that I like to jump up and down about is abstraction. Most developers, they write their JavaScript on the page where it's going to be executed, just in a little script tag right there. That's very difficult to test. But if you have a single JS file or multiple JS files that have abstracted through different business rules out of there, then you're going to be able to load it up in a testing framework, a JavaScript testing framework, and actually start testing those functions out of it.
Mm. That's pretty cool.
I see. One other question around that. I know with UI testing and such, you kind of walk the balance between automated and manual testing. Will you speak briefly to that? Like, when does it make sense to just test manually as opposed to doing automated tests? And when does it make, you know, and then when, in what situations? I assume most of the time you want to automate it whenever possible. But for some things, manual testing may be better. What are your thoughts on that, manual versus automated testing?
Okay. I started off my career in the financial industry, and I used to write IVR systems for banks, integrated voice response systems. You call up your bank, and you would say, what is the checking account in my, or what is the balance of my checking account? And it would come back, and it would tell you. You could do it with touch tone. And the application was abstracted out that I've never seen before. It was just awesome. There was a host interface DLL that would communicate with the credit union and financial institutions just with their processors, like their servers. There was a DLL that kind of ran the call flow, so which question was asked, okay, they said this, go here, do this. And then there was another layer that was written in C++ that just managed all of the phone functions. It detected when to hang up, when the call was answered, all the touch tones, all that sort of stuff. Everything was abstracted out beautifully. But one problem is we had manual tests for everything. We had test plans written in Microsoft Word that were hundreds of pages long. Call this phone number, use this account, do this, do that. And I got to thinking one day, you know, I'm doing this 100-page test plan to just test to make sure that I can transfer from checking to savings account. And that's just the DLL right there. Why don't I write a program on top of it? We'll call it the host test program that can test transferring from checking to savings. So at that point, I wrote my own test harness. And then all of the testing of the host to make sure that the our interface into the credit unions and financial institutions were working correctly, it was all automated. Now, NUnit was just starting up. JUnit, JavaUnit was out for a while, and this was written in VB6, and there was a VB6 testing framework that was coming out on the market as well. But I had written my own testing framework and my own testing harness, as it's called, and that's very common in industries that they'll write their own testing frameworks to do that. But I wrote it to get rid of that manual testing plan. I still find value in manual testing. I don't think we're ever going to get away from manual testing because I am always going to want to have an eye on my work that I'm publishing out to the web, to anybody looking at it. That's my work. That's my name going on it. I want to make sure that it works, and I'm not going to trust the machine 100% to do that. And mainly it's because of UI things. I want to see how it looks. Is it aesthetically pleasing? Is it usable? Those sort of things we're never going to get away from. And a lot of times when we have a manual test, we get a lot of usability issues because when we have a new employee start up at our company, we'll say, hey, why don't you hop on this project for a while and create a manual test plan for how to do this function. So they'll take a day and they'll write a manual test plan for it. And what really comes out of it is they were testing the usability of that website. And they come back and say, yeah, this is really hard to use. We pretty much ditched their test plan that they did. We never use it again because we have automated tests around everything that they just did, but mm-hmm. we tested the usability.
Good deal. I was also wondering about performance testing. That's one of the other kind of big areas that we haven't really looked at yet. And I know performance testing is huge, both kind of in terms of scalability and then in terms of just making sure your website is running fast enough. I know when I click a button on a website, I want it to respond, within a second. And that can be the most frustrating thing when you're sitting at a website and waiting for a response and it's just not coming back. What are some best practices around performance testing?
Start early and test often is the biggest thing I can tell everybody to do. I'll tell you a good story about one of my clients that I have, and they are the Michigan High School Athletic Association. So they manage all of the sports, high school sports, inside of Michigan. So if you want to know what your football score is, you can go to the MHSA website. If you want to know girls soccer, if you need to register to be an official, you can go to this website and do it. And one of the big pushes that we had last fall was to be able to submit scores and schedules so that you could see all of this information about football or baseball or basketball on the website. The interesting thing about high school athletics and the MHSA website is most of the time there's not a lot of traffic on the website. There's 20,000 hits a day, pretty much. That's normal traffic. And then Football Fridays, when a football game is, everybody wants to get the scores. So on that one day alone, just between 7 and 10 o'clock, it jumps up to 2 million.
Oh, my gosh.
It goes way up like that. So how do you develop an application that works like that? It's very low, very low, very low, and then all of a sudden you have all this traffic. And what it was just testing everything to make sure that we're going to be able to handle this traffic. When we brought the site up, we brought it up on a content management system, and there were some concerns about the particular content management system that we were going to use and if it was going to be performant. And the very first thing we did was we did a load test on it. And the load test that we did was we brought up 15 servers to act kind of as zombies, and they're just clients, and what they do is they generate the load for the website. And then we brought up using their exact production hardware. We did this on a Sunday where there was not a lot of traffic going on anyway. And we brought the website down. And we took those metrics and figured out, okay, we now know when the website's going to go down. What do we need to do to fix it? And this was before we even developed the website. It was just the content management system. And when I say the website went down, that was a metric we developed that response times were greater than 3 seconds. That's what we consider the website going down. So it can handle a lot more, but our user experience, we want those users to 3 seconds or less get that response. So we had an idea of what it could handle, and then it was just as we were developing our modules and different things for the site is just revisiting that and testing that to make sure it was okay. A couple times we ran into issues where the database was taking too long to get back. There was too much data coming back to the server onto the website to be rendered. So some things that we had to do was limit the amount of data that's going through. So that's a huge one. If you just limit the amount of data, you're good to go. So that helped us a lot of times. And then one time we just found it was right before the playoffs. The playoffs were being introduced, and everybody wanted to see who was going to be part of the playoffs. It was a module that was reading out of the database, and it really didn't need to read out of the database that often. And it was just people were just hammering this website to see who was going to be part of the tournament, who was in there, who was in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it just brought the website down. So we just turned on caching. We'll cache that website, that particular page for five minutes, and then all of the performance issues went away. It's keeping a constant eye on that traffic and knowing that's going to happen. Luckily, the guys at MHSAA, they're hardware guys, and they love their hardware. So they have fiber coming in here. They have big servers in the back. They host everything themselves, and they keep an eye on that. And when I first started on the project, they gave me the exact numbers of what was going to happen. And the only requirement they had is they said, let us know when it's going to fail and when we need to buy new stuff. So we have these numbers. We look at Google Analytics every week to see the numbers. Are they increasing? What's going to happen in fall of 2010 with the sporting stuff, with the scores and schedules, everybody coming in, and just curious, are we going to need to move to a web farm this year? So far, we haven't had to move to a web farm. Their machine that they have back there with 80 gigs of RAM is serving up the website perfectly fine, but eventually, if we get enough traffic into the website, we're just going to have to move it into a web farm.
Yeah.
But we know...
They sound like a great candidate for cloud computing, like running their normal service right then, and then when you get to the point on those Fridays or when those tournament people are up to be announced, roll over to something like Windows Azure and just have that scale for you, and then turn it off when you don't need it.
And that's exactly our plan this coming up year with some of the stuff, especially before the playoffs, when the playoffs are released, is doing something in Azure so that it goes up there and then they just pay for the traffic that they use, and then when we're done with it, we're done with it. We don't have to worry about it.
Good deal.
Right. We have a question from William. It's kind of a long one. Let's see if we can distill it down. He's saying that he runs into many different techniques for navigating from field to field, whether you validate data as it is entered versus when you submit the entire form, as well as other aspects of the user experience. So he's looking for a good source of data entry styles and conventions. And then once you pick one, are there tests for seeing if your selected techniques are accessible?
Kind of thinking about that is, depending on how you're doing your validation, if you're doing just pure JavaScript validation, then you're definitely going to have to do it two places, depending on how accessible you want to have your website. Because if somebody turns off JavaScript, then if you're not using the ASP.NET controls or controls that aren't in JavaScript, then what's going to happen is they're going to be able to submit their form without being validated. I use the ASP.NET controls for the validation stuff because it handles most of the stuff and accessibility and all that jazz. But I also validate my stuff on the server side as well. I check to see if I have this information, and if I don't, I return a status code with what's missing back. And that happens to be with the abstractions. And a lot of times what I'll do is I'll have a method called save contact if I'm trying to save the contact. And if save contact has an empty first name or empty last name, that's going to fail to save, and it'll give me a return code back that says this has failed. So then it's pretty much I write tests around that, the abstraction, which is the save contact method and class right there. I write tests around that, make sure that's okay. And then if the UI passes something in, I know that it's going to come back and say that there's issues.
All right. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you've got to be sort of really dynamic in what you're trying to test for. And you mentioned earlier, FXCOP for some of the sort of programming standards. Are there other techniques for sort of making department or company-wide standards for accessibility in websites that people design? Does that make sense?
I think education is the biggest thing that you can do for a department.
Okay.
When I first started designing sites, and I designed, how I got into accessibility was off of government sites where I had to adhere to Section 508 compliance, which is one of those regulatory things that we have to do to do a website for government. And I really wish that I had somebody to hold my hand through the whole process, because I was reading off the websites and reading the actual legal speak of how to do this, and it just was not, it just took forever to learn how to do that. There's a good book out, I forget the guy's name, but it's actually from the Pragmatic Press, and what it is he talks about each one of these accessibility rules and how to implement it. He takes it from the lawyer speak and puts it into normal person speak, and it's just awesome. It just makes that, that's pretty much how I learned how to write accessible websites, was because of this book. And in the notes for this webcast, we'll definitely get that in there. But it's from the Pragmatic Press, and it's Creating Accessible Websites. It's a white book with kind of like a blue hedge maze on the front of it. It's just awesome. It just makes life so much easier. And every time we get somebody new in our company, or I work with a web developer, we definitely talk about these techniques and why we do them. And there's some weird laws in there that are very difficult for people to follow. Like one of them, and there's different priorities off of each one of these WCAG 1.0, 2.0. If you want to be fully compliant, WCAG 1.0 priority 3, when you have video on your website, you need to provide not only subcaptions, but you also have to provide a sign language bubble in the upper right corner.
Oh, wow.
And I've been on projects where we've had to be that accessible for websites, and finding vendors to do that is very difficult and very expensive. So a lot of times the websites I make, they're not 100% accessible under WCAG 1.0 Priority 3 because of that, because of the little speech, the sign language bubble in the upper right corner. But if I have a video, one of the things that accessibility says is you have to provide control for the user to stop it and replay it, and you can't automatically play the video when a user comes to your site. So if you've ever been out to, like, ESPN, all those videos just start playing, they're not accessible. And they're not accessible because somebody using the screen reader like JAWS, it's trying to read the screen, and then this video's going along and trying to read too, and then it just gets to be a big jumble of all these words going at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So, while we're on the subject of accessibility testing and UI, what are the considerations for testing if your UI is not HTML and CSS? For example, if it's an RIA platform like Flash or Silverlight.
Both of those RIA frameworks have controls and have a couple things that you can do to make things easier for testing accessibility, but they're not really accessible. Some portions are, some aren't. I'm definitely not an expert with those,
sure.
But I really try to stay away from doing that if I know that I have to have a site that's accessible. One of the other things that you hear a lot of times is you have to be able to select the text on the page. So you have to be able to, like, highlight it. That kind of is a little bit blown out of proportion, but it comes from one of the accessibility rules that says if you can relay something through text, don't use an image. So if you can put it in text, it's going to, more than likely, JAWS is going to be able to read it when it's a text. But RIA applications definitely will have issues.
Okay.
Yeah, I can see that. Could I turn it back to performance testing for 1 second?
Sure.
We were talking about that. I know you've mentioned in the past a number of amazing tools to help with performance testing, the IIS log parser, NetStat, I think the ANS profiler, Firebug. There's a whole bunch of good things out there, I know, Fiddler, and I know Visual Studio contains a bunch of stuff as well, specifically for performance testing. Could you speak to some of those tools and how they might be able to help with performance testing?
Sure. I guess the first one that grabbed my attention out of there was the ANS profiler from RevGate. That is a commercial tool, but they give you this great 30-day trial on it. And that's kind of the first thing that we need to do with testing for performance and scalability is we need to profile our code to see, is our code actually okay? Is there something, did somebody put a sleep someplace that's making this code execute slow? So we're not even worrying about requests coming in, anything like that. We want to run our code through this profiler. And with the ANS profiler, what you do is you start it up, and then you tell it, attach it to this website, and then you go and you navigate your website. And then ANS is in the back collecting all this data, running through everything that it needs to do. And then when you're done running through your website, you click stop, and the ANS profiler tabulates this nice list of data for you. And the big thing that it does is inputs hot methods at the very top of the list. A hot method is where it are your longest running methods. And then you're able to see, oh, wow, getting a list of contacts from the database took 34 seconds. That was my longest running method. Maybe if I scale that down to get less, that'll make it a lot faster, make my program more performant. So that's kind of the first kind of line of defense, is running it through a profiler doing that. There is a profiler inside of Visual Studio. I do think that the ANS profiler gives us a little more options, but if you're on a team and you need to be able to have a profiler, the Visual Studio one is definitely cool and is definitely an awesome tool. The other thing that we do a lot of times is actually testing the requests and responses of the websites going back and forth, seeing what's going. And one of the tools that we can use to do that is WCAT. The abbreviation is escaping me right now. But it's a tool that's been out for years from Microsoft. It's part of the IIS resource kit. And it's a command line tool. And what you do is you set up a server. That server could just be your desktop machine. And then just like the previous example that I was speaking of, you kind of have zombies or clients. And you bring up these clients, and they read out of a file to generate the load for your website. So you bring up the server, maybe two or three of these little clients. The clients are generating load, and the clients are reporting back to the server how long each request and response took on each page. And one of the great things about this tool is you can use it in conjunction with another free tool from Microsoft called the IIS Log Parser. And what that'll do is that'll take your IIS logs, and then that'll generate all the load for you. So you can take your 2 months of history that your website currently has, dump it into the IIS Log Parser, then dump it into WCAT, and then you can reproduce that exact amount of traffic that was being run for that given time. Great use of tools. They're free tools. They're awesome. The other way that I do this is I actually use Visual Studio Team Test Edition with the newer things. I think it's in Ultimate. And what you can do is you can write a whole bunch of these user interface tests like we were talking about earlier. You kind of record a browser session. It opens up this little recorder. You go through and say, okay, I want to go to Bing.com, do this search, check to make sure that these results were returned. I'm looking for 10 of these guys if your site was Bing. But if it's your client site, you go to your client site and you kind of do your little test. And what happens is because you're writing all these tests with all these asserts and everything, doing your functional tests, you accumulate this massive amount of these web tests. You can take all those web tests and do what Microsoft calls a load test inside of this nice little wizard interface. And then you create your load test, and it gives you options for how many users you'd like to generate. It can default to 25, gives you some option for stepping the load if you wanted to start up at like 5 users, 10 users. It will do stuff like your network type if it's a 56K modem, your LAN type. It'll be able to give you some delays on how it expects traffic to behave. You can change browsers to Windows 7, Internet Explorer, Firefox, Safari, all those sort of things. If your website is looking for browser specifics, you can kind of mask those different browsers. And then when you're done, you click Run Test, and it goes out and it just starts hammering your website. And the coolest thing about this tool is all the charts that it provides. It gives you your load, and then you can hook it up with performance counters in .NET. So if you're on the same network, you can go over to your SQL Server and you can grab all its performance counters to see what's going on there. You can grab all your IIS performance counters and see what's going on. And it just makes all these charts and all these colors, and managers are just so happy to be able to see all these charts with all these numbers. And they definitely love this tool. And this is one of my favorite tools for doing load testing.
That's very cool. Yeah, having those sort of tangible results you can show really makes it worth the time. And I think, you know, as we wrap up, it's important for people to realize that it's time. It's good to make the time to do the testing that you need to do. And I think it's overlooked in a lot of scenarios, and it comes back to bite people in the end.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's true.
So we've got a slide that we just brought up, which has some good links. It has a reference to our MSDN GeekSpeak webcast blog. So what folks can do is they can go to that blog in the next couple of days, and we'll be posting up a set of resources that we'll get from Jeff related to the topics that he's mentioned today. So if you missed some of the links or some of the things that he's mentioned. We'll just check the webcast blog in about a week. You can also check for our upcoming GeekSpeak webcasts at msdngeekspeak.com or catch some of our previous recordings on Channel 9. This page also has our, or the slide rather, has my blog and Jennifer's blog, and we've got Jeff, we've got your blog here as well. And the previous slide I didn't point out, but we're also available on Twitter, so if you want to connect with us that way, you can look us up through Twitter. So with that, I want to thank Jeff for spending this hour with us and enlightening us about the importance of web testing from many different perspectives.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks. And Jennifer, thanks for being a co-host.
No problem.
And at this point, we'll toss it back over to Bennett to do some final wrap-up.